Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's firing of Chris Krebs, the government's top cybersecurity official in charge of DHS's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, who, instead of being congratulated for protecting the recent election from foreign interference, was fired by tweet for contradicting Trump's bogus claims of voter fraud and knocking down ridiculous conspiracy theories from the likes of Stephen Bannon. Sean Lingus, a senior reporter at CyberScoop, who covers the Department of Homeland Security, joins us to discuss his latest article, Trump Fires CISA Chief Chris Krebs, who guarded the 2020 election from interference and misinformation. We'll examine CISA's primary role of protecting the nation's vital infrastructure and the reckless stupidity of Trump's petty vengeance, since the former Microsoft executive Chris Krebs was doing important work protecting hospitals from ransomware attacks at a time when the COVID pandemic has hospitals at the breaking point. With Krebs essentially getting punished for keeping Putin and other malign actors at bay in protecting our election, we are left to assume that Trump would have preferred a different outcome in which the votes were rigged in his favor, now that he's flaying about trying to invent evidence of voter fraud that does not exist. Then, with the White House press secretary saying restrictions on social gatherings at Thanksgiving are Orwellian, we will speak with the author of a new survey which assesses the risks of large Thanksgiving holiday get-togethers amidst the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Ian Gonsalhauser, Chief Quality and Patient Safety Officer at the Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center, joins us to discuss his survey, which found 40% of Americans plan to gather in groups of 10 or more, with 33% of them not wearing masks and 25% not practicing social distancing. Then finally, we will speak with Tamara Luce, Chair and Professor of History and Asian Studies at the Center for International Studies at Cornell University. An expert on Thailand, she's the author of Bones Around My Neck, The Life and Exile of a Prince Provocateur, and joins us to discuss a country in turmoil over the divide between the yellow shirts who support the monarchy and the red shirts who want democracy and the end of military rule. With the king's consort taking a more public role, we explore the reasons for the loyalty his subjects have towards this absentee monarch whose excess and entitlement knows no bounds. And before we go to our first guest, I want to thank you, our listeners and supporters, who have donated to sustain and build Background Briefing as the radio station we broadcast from closes down and we transition to online broadcasting, particularly during this pandemic. Your donations will help us improve our recording capabilities from home, so we encourage you to throw us a lifeline and join the fact-based community of listeners we are building around the globe with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate, which helps keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to all those who are not in a position to contribute. And joining us now is Sean Lingus, who is a senior reporter at CyberScoop covering the Department of Homeland Security and Congress. His reporting also has appeared in the Washington Post, The Economist, and the BBC. And his latest article at CyberScoop is Trump Fires CISA Chief Chris Krebs, who guarded the 2020 election from interference and domestic misinformation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sean Lingus.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
So, Sean, what are we to make of the fact that Chris Krebs basically took credit, and it was totally justified, for protecting this recent election, which was the most secure election in the country's history? There was a lot of reporting, and I think you and I spoke before the election, and I certainly covered a lot of these dire scenarios that were expected with Russian interference and all kinds of the Iranians, you name it, everybody was going to weigh in and screw the whole thing up, and that there'd be civil strife and militias with guns going to polling places and all of that stuff that we expected, none of which happened. So what is going on? Why did the president attack this guy?
Right. So what's going on is the agency that Chris Krebs led until yesterday, the CISA, the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, was aggressively debunking and refuting some of the claims that were made by the president and his allies about the election being rife with fraud and other things. The agency, CISA, has been working with state and local election officials over the last 4 years, ever since the 2016 Russian interference, to restore trust between the agencies, but more importantly, boost security and information sharing and that sort of thing to protect the election. So once the foreign threat was mostly kept at bay, and it wasn't just the one agency, CISA, that did it, it was the U.S. military deploying some of its hacking teams. It was the FBI. It was state and local officials. But when that foreign threat kind of receded, the main threat became domestic misinformation, and that includes the baseless conspiracy theories that the president was propagating. And again, this agency is obviously within his administration, and they were carrying out their mission to ensure public confidence in the vote and knock down wild, crazy theories that might scare people from voting or convince them not to trust the results. And obviously, we have a big challenge in this country right now with many parts of the population distrusting the results. And so, again, the agency kept doing what it wanted to, what it was meant to do, and that came to the attention of the White House. And so, it's been swept up. Some of the agency officials, including Chris Krebs, have been swept up in this purge of loyal of officials who are deemed not loyal to the president.
But since Krebs is essentially getting punished for keeping Putin and other malign actors at bay in protecting the election, are we left to assume that Trump would have preferred a different outcome if the votes were rigged in his favor?
Yeah, I don't presume to know what the president would have preferred. Obviously, he would have preferred to win. But as you mentioned at the top of the interview, the election has been by a wide group of bipartisan election officials and by outside expert has been deemed free of any widespread fraud and largely secure by any fair measure of things. Of course, there are technical glitches that go wrong, and there are snafus during every election, but there's no evidence whatsoever to suggest that altered the outcome in any way. So, again, these people whose job it is to protect the election went about their business. And with the president turning to various, legal schemes to try to somehow claw back into the race, even though that's not possible, the desperation turned to retaliation, I think, against career officials and some political appointees who were just doing their jobs.
And again, I'm speaking with Sean Lingus, who's a senior reporter at CyberScoop, covering the Department of Homeland Security in Congress. His reporting also has appeared in The Washington Post, The Economist, and the BBC. And his latest article at CyberScoop is Trump Fires CISA Chief Chris Krebs, who guarded the 2020 election from interference and domestic misinformation. But my understanding is that CISA, which is a part of the Department of Homeland Security, its primary role is to protect the nation's vital infrastructure. And lately, they have apparently been protecting hospitals from ransomware attacks, which have been happening. And surely, given how hospitals now are at the breaking point because of the COVID pandemic,
right?
I don't know how vulnerable hospitals are, but without Chris Krebs being on the job, are we becoming more vulnerable to ransomware attacks, particularly in vital infrastructure like hospitals?
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned that, Ian, because that is, along with election security, right now the cybersecurity of healthcare systems is the second, top priority for CISA, and that's what they're focusing on. And in fact, a few minutes before you called me, the career official, his name is Brandon Wales, who is now leading the agency because of Krebs being fired and his deputy being forced out. He sent an email to the workforce that I obtained, and he harped on those two points, election security and ransomware in hospitals, and he urged the employees to stay focused on that. Now, there are, just like with election security, there are several, parts of the organization that do focus on healthcare, protecting healthcare. For example, they'd recently hired a well-regarded healthcare cybersecurity expert to help lead those efforts. So those people are still there. There's no question that it was a blow to morale to have the director fired like that. But there's been a lot of kind of pep talk messaging going on in the last 24 hours to ensure that the agency still focuses on those twin issues of election security and healthcare cybersecurity. So it's still a priority. And it's you have to keep the perspective in mind. It is a very important agency, but it's just one piece of things. A lot of these hospitals are really sort of desperate for security resources that they need. So they have private sector companies are coming and helping them respond to these cyber attacks. And so people can't take their eye off that. That was the number one thing that we were reporting on until in tandem with the election. And we just basically took a break to cover the election last week. And now I'm sure I'll write an article soon about the ransomware threat, because it's virtually an unprecedented in the U.S. Ransomware threat to hospitals. There have been multiple hospitals that have been infected, have their computer systems infected with this ransomware from suspected Eastern European criminals. So that thing, that is absolutely top of mind right now for a lot of people.
So tell us about Krebs and why he's so popular with bipartisan officials in the House and Senate have come to his defense. My understanding from your articles, Sean, is that he really did get to know the people in not just the cybersecurity world, but also in these researchers and what you call white hat hackers. Mm-hmm. And he went to DEF CON and Black Hat Las Vegas security conferences. So tell us about what's going on with white hat hackers and sure. Black Hat and these games that are being obviously gamed out.
Right. Yeah. Well, first of all, he has a lot of charisma and, has good relationships in the media and in government and in the private sector. He used to work at Microsoft. And so he was able to connect with people in terms of at the hacking conferences, because he was showing up in casual clothes, was doing a lot of listening. Of course, he'd make a speech, because the government official has to make a speech. But I think he realized that he needed to connect with some of those people, that they had misconceptions about the government, the way the government worked and what his agency was doing. His agency is actually an easy pitch to the private sector, because they're completely defensive. They're not like the NSA, which is, going on the offensive cyberspace, albeit not in the U.S. But the sell for him was easier, because he could basically say, I'm here to listen. And so, he ended up recruiting some people from that sort of the cybersecurity conference community. The person I alluded to earlier on the healthcare side, his name's Josh Corman. Was very active at those hacking conferences as a researcher, and he's now working at CISA. So he was able to connect in a way that I think most government officials couldn't, and it had to do with charisma, but partly he was really putting in the effort too.
And how did he work with Cyber Command, with General Nakasone? Because I understand that Nakasone also deserves credit for protecting our recent election.
I think that's right. I mean, they clearly had a close personal relationship. It's something, having covered these agencies for a while now, it was pretty striking to see. I knew it was going to be an issue, a factor in the protection of the election, but it actually surpassed my expectations in terms of the way that they seem to work together, by all accounts. Nakasone made a decision very early on, for as far back as the 2018 midterm elections, that his military units, computer specialists were going to go out on the offensive. They use various euphemisms for it, but it really is offensive cyber operations. And they were helped by Congress giving them more authority, by the White House giving them more authority, and so that relationship between Krebs and Nakasone was definitely integral to the election security. Nakasone's team was passing on, classified information to Krebs' team that could then declassify that in some cases and put it out to the private sector or disseminate it to election officials or both. So that relationship is, I'm sure that General Nakasone right now is definitely ruining the firing of Chris Krebs. And it'll be interesting to see how whoever eventually succeeds in the long term to medium term, how those agencies will work together. Because I think by, an objective observer would say they've gotten much better at working together. And the election security, it's a key part of election security. The NSA, the National Security Agency, as well as Cyber Command, the two organizations that General Nakasone leads, they each had a senior person that designated to election security who would do it full time. So that really is an effective partnership, I think.
Well, they've got to be wondering, people like General Nakasone, is whose side is our president on? I mean, it's just extraordinary to punish the good guys. And I don't, I'm not necessarily suggesting that he's sorry that Putin didn't have a free hand. And maybe it's just petty vengeance on the president's part because he got contradicted because of his current made up sort of narrative that he won the election as he flays about trying to find some evidence. But in general, since you work this beat, what's the status of morale in these organizations?
Right. I mean, within the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, I mean, people have been working overtime on election security for months. And I think last night people were naturally very sad about the firing. But a lot of people people are still going to work and showing up at their jobs and doing them. So, like I said, there's an effort to sort of rally the troops. The new person who's the leading of CISA on an acting basis, his name is Brandon Wales, like I said, and he's well respected. He's not going to command the sort of admiration that Krebs would instinctively, but he's still widely seen as a smart, capable person who's just trying to keep the ship going. I'm sure morale is all over the place in various agencies, and people are just trying to see this out, keep protecting the country. But people are also speaking up more and more and are very frustrated. In my article today that I did on the state of play at CISA, a former senior official named Brian Harrell, who resigned earlier this year to leave for the private sector, he commented for my story and said it was outrageous or shameful, I think was the word he used, that Krebs would be fired for speaking the truth. So people are speaking out more. And in terms of Republican response to the firing, it's been slowly trickling in. It's so politicized, unfortunately, the environment we live in. There have been a handful of lawmakers who have, maybe one or two Republican lawmakers who have criticized the decision. There have been a couple of who have said good things about Chris Krebs, but nothing about the White House decision. I can think of a couple Republicans. I think Mitt Romney, Ben Sasse, and Will Hurd, Congressman Will Hurd, are the three that come to mind who I think have criticized the White House for the decision. But other than that, it's been a pretty deafening silence.
Well, Sean Lingus, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks very much for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Sean Lingus, who's a senior reporter at CyberScoop, covering the Department of Homeland Security in Congress. His reporting also has appeared in The Washington Post, The Economist, and the BBC. And his latest article at CyberScoop is Trump Fires CISA Chief Chris Krebs, who guarded the 2020 election from interference and domestic misinformation. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with the author of a survey which found 40% of Americans plan to gather in groups of 10 or more over Thanksgiving, with more than 33% of them not wearing masks and 25% not practicing social distancing. Megadel, cyberpunk technology such as cyberbots. Check the rhymes, I can cock private stock. While you jock, I set up ultra security for MC intelligence who wanna murder me. It's like the third degree, the way I question my sanity. I work on cybernetics as a form of vanity to protect my
my circuitry, I stay under the canopy. I sent for special chips to finish my fantasy, to become a bionic commando, monitor scandals, solar panels reflect, energy enters me. If this energy in the 21st century, soldering temper release, fusible alloys like...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Ian Gonsenhauser, who's a Chief Quality and Patient Safety Officer at the Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center, where he just conducted a national survey assessing the risks of large holiday gatherings amidst the COVID-19 pandemic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Ian Gonsenhauser.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us. And your study has found that about 40% of U.S. residents say they plan to gather in groups of 10 or more people over the Thanksgiving holiday. And among them, only 33% of the respondents say they would not require friends or family to wear masks at these Thanksgiving gatherings. And 25% said they would not practice social distancing. So those are pretty alarming statistics. So are we then to expect that on Thanksgiving across the country, there'll be a number of super spreader events?
Yeah, you know, I think that that's a reasonable expectation. You know, we were disappointed. I was disappointed by the findings of the study. Obviously, I want to hear that everybody is taking this as seriously as they can. They're realizing the risk. They identify the opportunities that multiple household gatherings present as far as the viral spread can go. And was really hoping to see a much smaller number of people who were still moving in this direction. Obviously, if we see large gatherings, if we see extensive gatherings across the country, which this data would lead us to believe that's going to happen. And I think a lot of the rhetoric and the messaging that we see, you know, in the media and in social media and elsewhere, certainly there are a lot of people that are moving in this direction. If that's the case, and we see these multiple household gatherings for Thanksgiving, long dinners around the dinner table, no masks, while people are eating and drinking, one can expect that we're going to see a further surge of these numbers following the Thanksgiving holiday.
Well, speaking of rhetoric, the White House Press Secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, said that on Fox and Friends on Wednesday that these suggestions and guidelines from governors are Orwellian. So she's taking the opposite stance, at least the opposite stance from what your study or your survey would indicate.
Yeah, you know, I won't speak to the messaging that's coming out of the White House. I mean, I would ask the simple fact, would the same group of people think that being called up to the draft in a time of conflict, is that Orwellian as well?
Or is it Orwellian to wear a seatbelt in a car?
Correct. I mean, I think we can point to any number of social norms and things that we do to preserve the public health and public safety. We can look at any of those laws and restrictions and claim that that's infringing on some sort of right. But I think we all have a responsibility in this nation to look out for one another, regardless of what our political beliefs or stances may be. I mean, for me, I'm a public health servant. I'm a physician. I'm a hospital leader. My days 24/7 are committed to the health and well-being of the citizens of Ohio, of Central Ohio, and the country at large. And I think we should all be making the decisions that we know are going to protect one another, keep each other healthy, and get us to dig out of this crisis, because this is a public health crisis. People are dying every day. We've got to do what we can to try and pull ourselves back together.
And nationwide, we're at the 250,000 deaths statistic, which is extraordinarily appalling. I heard a statistic that we are losing more Americans per day than we lost at the height of World War II in 1944. And we have also over 11 million cases in the country. So these statistics are alarming enough. But what your survey is telling us here is that over this Thanksgiving holiday, if you take five of next week's Thanksgiving gatherings, you can expect that a coronavirus positive person will be at two of them. That's the overall statistic, right?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, we know that these cases are widespread across the nation now. We know that they're only increasing. And as we approach the holiday in just less than a couple of weeks, we know that as we approach it, the numbers are going to continue to expand. And there will be more and more both symptomatic and asymptomatic positives. And it's those asymptomatic positives that are our biggest concern. Those are the folks that can be sitting at the dinner table with you and nobody's any the wiser. And after a period of time, again, around the dinner table, not distanced, with no masks, that is a prime opportunity for this virus to spread. And we can expect that it will.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Ian Gonsenhauser, who's Chief Quality and Patient Safety Officer at The Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center, where he has just conducted a national survey assessing the risks of large holiday gatherings amidst the COVID-19 pandemic. And The Washington Post has also a map of the coronavirus hotspots across the country, where effectively the entire middle of the country is red hot. And then as you go out to the coasts, it sort of thins out to the point where on the West Coast it's pretty light, and on the East Coast it's not quite as light. But still, there is a variation clearly within the country of how certain regions are really badly infested.
Yeah, well, if you'll remember, you know, when this was just finding its way to U.S. shores, when it first landed here in the U.S., it landed really on the coasts in the highly trafficked sort of international first stop destinations, Northern California, San Francisco area, and New York as well. So the first round of this really hit those coastal populous metropolitan areas first. And while back in April, March and April, we thought it was, you know, it was pretty devastating what we saw happen in New York. What we didn't realize is that devastation was occurring in a place that was actually taking precautions very seriously. I mean, they started their response, you know, almost immediately. And we still saw that huge surge and that huge peak. It took a while for the virus to move from those populous centers into rural America. And that's what we saw happen about a month ago. The virus finally made it into the interior, into the less populous, less densely populated areas of the country. And what it found there was a ripe and fertile playground, an environment where people were less likely to be taking precautions, less likely to be distancing, more averse to wearing masks. And when the virus found its way into those communities, it absolutely exploded. And so what we saw happen is the population that was affected by the virus increased dramatically, mainly in the interior of the U.S. And then we saw, you know, that burden of infection start to splash back into the metropolitan area. So you sort of saw it move centrally and then move back out from the center of the country. And if you've been watching the map over the past week or so, it's creeping slowly but surely back to the coasts. And I would assume that, you know, before a few weeks are up, we're going to see those coastal areas, those coastal states in the red as well.
But at this point, for example, in the upper Midwest, in Cook County, Illinois, which is where Chicago is, the risk is about 60%. So that means that if you attend two Thanksgiving dinners in Cook County, you will encounter a coronavirus positive person at least at one of them. And then in El Paso, the risk is 90%. And across North Dakota, the odds are anywhere from 95 to 100%. So that is extraordinary. I read somewhere that North Dakota has the worst infestation in the world. Is that your understanding?
In the world, yeah, that's correct. That's what I've read as well. That's what the numbers would reflect. And your numbers are accurate. You know, we're at a point now where people can expect, if they are not being extremely vigilant with their precautions, they are going to encounter a COVID-positive patient. And at that point, you know, it's leaving it to chance. If they're not taking those precautions, they're leaving to chance whether or not they're impacted themselves.
So here in California, of course, we're lucky with the weather, particularly in Southern California. So is an outdoor Thanksgiving socially distanced? You'd have to have pretty big tables, I guess. Is that okay, do you think?
Yeah, you know, my joke has been that this year we're finally going to have tables big enough to hold all the food because we're going to need to have tables large enough that people can really truly social distance outdoors if they are outdoors. What I would suggest, so the outdoor environment is decidedly lower risk than the indoor environment. Being outdoors is not a reason to eschew your precautions. You really want to keep those precautions going. You want to maximize mask utilization, and you do want to still social distance. If you are deciding in a warmer climate to have an outdoor multi-household Thanksgiving celebration, my recommendation would be to have multiple tables where you seat individual households at their own table so that those tables can be significantly distanced from one another, at least 6 feet apart, and provide a way of serving food that there is no commingling and passing of platters and trays back and forth between tables, but rather serve family style within each table so that you can try and reduce the mingling and mixing as much as possible. Again, the best thing we can do is not bring households together, do it virtually, or do a driveway, front yard, brief hello in person, and then go and have your meal separately with just the members of your household. But if you are bringing households together, outdoors is the best choice. Separate tables for separate households, plenty of hand sanitizer available, maximize masks if you can, and really try and be aware, because as we get together in these carefree situations and we're eating good food and we're maybe drinking some wine, it becomes very easy to become relaxed, complacent, and let those precautions slip. And it's in that moment that this virus has no sympathy for you.
But getting to the Thanksgiving table itself poses risks, doesn't it? Particularly if you fly?
Absolutely. So most places around the country right now are beginning to issue travel advisories, really recommending that people don't travel, period, let alone travel by air. I mean, what we've seen is a lot of work done in the airplanes themselves, that the airlines have put work towards improving the ventilation and HEPA filtration systems. And we haven't seen really a lot of transmission in the actual flight part of air travel. But what we have seen is transmission that's related to other things that are connected to air travel, and that is potentially taking ride sharing or public transport to the airport, waiting in lines at the airport ticket line or the TSA or at Starbucks or wherever. Those are the things that all put you in that higher risk environment again, those higher risk situations, and that's what you really want to avoid. It's because of that driving is perceived as a bit safer because you don't have as many of those moments where you're potentially stuck in a crowd. Even if they are social distancing, you're still in a crowd when you're flying quite frequently. And that's where the risk is elevated.
And of course, if you're driving, you're usually driving with your family. So how do families deal with that? You know, say you have your relatives driving down from San Francisco to Los Angeles, and they're going to be sitting at a separate table outdoors. What is the protocol there in terms of, do you ask them to make sure everybody's been tested?
Yeah, you know, when it comes to the testing component of this, there is a way that you can use testing to try and reduce your risk. I mean, you're not going to eliminate risk, that's for sure, but you can use it to reduce your risk. Now, you have to be pretty diligent and pretty explicit around how you're going to use testing and the circumstances that you're going to use testing in, most notably quarantining for a significant period of time prior to your test. So if you want to use a test and you want that test to be reliable, you have to assure that you have not had an exposure within, 36 to 48 hours of your test, prior to your test. Because if you have been exposed in that time frame, there's the potential that your test can be negative, even though you've contracted the infection and you may be contagious, in the days that follow. So a really strict quarantine protocol prior to being tested is important. And then assuring that you're quarantining and taking really, really explicit precautions and reliable, diligent precautions following your test to assure that you don't have an exposure after your test has been conducted. One of the things that people can do to try and make their test a bit more reliable, because there is a concern about false negatives, is to have multiple tests prior to getting together for a family event. And that would mean going into quarantine for approximately 7 days. After 3 days of your quarantine or 4 days of your quarantine, being tested, waiting another few days and then being tested again, and then staying in your quarantine again with those diligent precautions to prevent any exposure prior to traveling and being with your family. If you can do that and your tests are negative, you're significantly lower risk of potentially carrying the virus. But everybody who you're going to come in contact with essentially has to do the same thing. And it's very difficult to get everybody to adopt that level of rigor and do things in a way that will be reliable for you.
Well, how quick, though, are the turnarounds? I mean, if the test takes several days to get back to you, you could get infected in the interregnum, couldn't you?
You certainly can. And so that's the concern about what they call the PCR test, the genetic test, which is a bit longer turnaround time. There is a pretty extensive availability now of the rapid tests, which result, you know, within 15 to 30 minutes. And the FDA just approved an at-home test. It's not widely available yet, but will be shortly. But again, with those tests, with the more rapid tests, you need to be a bit more cautious about false or unreliable results. Again, false negatives can happen. False positives can also happen. So really just being cautious that you're using those tests really in duplicate if you're using a rapid test to assure that your results are reliable.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, I mean, I guess the good news, if I could say that, about your survey that you've done on the risks of Thanksgiving dinners, or I guess lunches or whatever. Some people start earlier in the day, but the good news, if I can use that term, is that 80% of respondents to the Ohio State University survey that you did would ask family and friends not to come if they experienced symptoms of the virus. And those symptoms would be, just briefly, if you don't mind telling us.
Yeah, so very similar to cold and flu symptoms. Many times people are presenting with sort of basic allergy and sinus infection type symptoms. So runny nose, cough, congestion, fever. Certainly if you're experiencing loss of smell or taste, if you're experiencing fatigue, shortness of breath, those are really your primary symptoms that you want to look for.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. I guess you're feeling a bit like the Grinch at Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah, I'm kind of the Grinch that's stealing Thanksgiving. But, you know, it's a small price to pay so that we can enjoy the upcoming winter holidays together. I know Thanksgiving is a big holiday for people, but we've got a lot of other holidays coming as well. And we certainly want to have as many of our family members as possible with us for our next Thanksgiving as well. And if we're not cautious about this right now, we could very, very rapidly find ourselves again in a lockdown situation. And that's not what anybody wants.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Dr. Ian Gonsenhauser.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Ian Gonsenhauser, who's the Chief Quality and Patient Safety Officer at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, where he just conducted a national survey assessing the risks of large holiday gatherings amidst the COVID-19 pandemic. We can take a brief station break and back look into the loyalty the King of Thailand's subjects have towards this absentee monarch whose excess and entitlement knows no bounds. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Tamara Luce, who is the Chair and Professor of History and Asian Studies at the Center for International Studies at Cornell University. She's the author of two books about Thai politics and history, Subject Siam, Family Law and Colonial Modernity in Thailand, and most recently, Bones Around My Neck, The Life and Exile of a Prince Provocateur. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tamara Luce.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, thanks for joining us. And it is pretty extraordinary that you've had this divide in Thailand and all of this political turmoil between the yellow shirts who support the monarchy and the red shirts who want democracy and the end of military rule. But it feels in a way that having the king's consort taking a more public role is sort of rubbing salt into the wounds. I mean, how does the monarchy hold its grip over a country where you, of course, get fined if you criticize the monarchy, or you get jailed, as a matter of fact? At the same time, they seem to be excessive, almost in the kind of Marie Antoinette style of let them eat cake, with the consort running around and the king living in Germany in a castle in Bavaria and having $70 billion in the family coffers, and then expecting the Thai people to contribute another billion to his lavish lifestyle.
Yeah, it is pretty extraordinary to watch right now. And part of what you're seeing is a media blitzkrieg, as the article mentioned, in which the king is sending out family members, and he himself is going out, and he's sending out his daughters and his royal noble consort, who he's recently reinstated, to various parts of the countryside in a way to try to bridge the growing gap between many people who are challenging the role of the monarchy and the monarchy itself. So this is just an attempt to regain loyalty and to kind of charge up followers, yellow shirts and former yellow shirts of the monarchy.
And the
article, whether it'll work or not is a different issue.
Right. Well, the article you mentioned, of course, is a front page story in Wednesday's Los Angeles Times, "A Royal Consort's Charm Offensive. Girlfriend of married Thai King takes an unusual public role amid ire at monarchy." But the monarchy is not doing anything to deal with the excesses and the kind of absurdity which I mentioned of a king that prefers to live in a castle in Bavaria, has what, mm-hmm. he's on his third wife. He's got this consort that he's just elevated to some kind of royal position. And I think he's got another girlfriend as well. And the family fortune is about $70 billion. And now they're asking the Thai people to contribute an extra $1 billion to support this king's lavish lifestyle. I mean, mm-hmm. our president, Donald Trump, could only dream of having the kind of women at the disposal that this king has.
I'm going to hold my tongue on politics in the United States right now, but I will talk a little bit about the current king of Thailand and the kind of optics that you're mentioning, both financial optics, but also what many people might want to call personal or family style. Those optics are also pretty negative. And there's a couple things that I should probably say. The Crown Property Bureau, which is the source of King Witjiralongkorn's wealth, was associated with the institution of the monarchy, but was really a source of funding that the former king used to actually promote development projects within Thailand. One of the first things that King Witjiralongkorn did when he became king, when he ascended the throne, was to claim the Crown Property Bureau assets as his own personal wealth. So that wealth, it's questionable whether that's really family wealth. I would say it's not. And that's one of the reasons why the protesters are up in arms at the moment and holding out signs like "My Taxes," because they see this funding as the source of funding as something that really should return to Thailand and be used for the benefit of the Thai population. What we're seeing instead is reports of the king living quite lavishly in southern Germany. And spending these funds on things like a 40-piece helicopter and jet set that he can use that are at his own personal disposal. So the protesters are, of course, focusing on the use of those funds, the misuse of those funds. But one of the things I would say they're also focusing on is how these optics are really revealing a kind of monarch that no longer suits the ethics of the younger generation, which is the generation that's really out there in numbers on the streets in Bangkok and in the provinces, right? So what I would say is, like, the political culture of the monarchy and the kind of status quo establishment that would be affiliated with the yellow shirts is intensely patriarchal and male dominated. The new generation of protesters, by contrast, presumes a commitment to equality. And a lot of times you'll see, if you're looking at images of the protest, you'll see that sexual diversity and gender equality are some of the issues that that are prevalent, right, in the rainbow branding of many of the protests. So for me, that contrast is instructive and related. So even when you think about the main demands made by the protesters, which is, the resignation of the current prime minister, Prayut, a change in the constitution to allow for more participatory democracy, and also a change in the monarchy so that it's truly a constitutional monarchy that is subject to law and whose finances are subject to auditing. Those changes don't look on the face of it like they have anything to do with gender or sexuality, but I think that they are intensely related to this particular king's optics. There's a relationship between the outpouring of support by women and by those who promote gender and sexual diversity on the one hand, and the kind of retrenchment and intensification of gender inequality and even sexism that you see in the activities of the monarch, right, and the prime minister as well. And that's an important thing and a link to the reappointment of the royal noble consort. We could talk about that, but it's also important to point out that this king's optics are really different than his father's. And his father died in 2016. King Bhumibol, who's the previous king, promoted frugality. He promoted personal reserve and kind of traditional heteronormative monogamy. But his son has been married actually four times. He's on his fourth wife. And he's resurrected the long dead institution of polygyny, right? And he did this on his birthday in 2019. That's when he appointed Siminat as his royal noble consort. And that was the first kind of reappointment of that sort in about 100 years.
But Sinat, her nickname is Goy, which is a cheap, spicy dish of raw beef. So at least it seems that there's a kind of grassroots rebellion against these sort of Marie Antoinette type excesses. And I believe a defining moment was when a 21-year-old college student read a 10-point manifesto for limiting the monarchy's powers. And that, of course, she was risking, up to 15 years in prison, because it's a criminal offense to criticize the royal family, or particularly the king. So Where is the shift underway now in terms of the emperor having no clothes?
Well, people have known about King Wijiralongkorn's kind of disreputable behavior well before he became king. And this was, in fact, one of the things behind those color-coded protests that led to a coup in 2006 and in 2014. Those coups by the military were meant to maintain a sort of stability until there was a transition between the ailing Rama the Ninth or King Bhumibol and the ascendancy of his son, King Wijiralongkorn. And people were really worried about that. And for good reason, because King Wijiralongkorn already had a reputation that was unethical, to say the least. So I think that when we saw Banut Saya Rung, this young woman you're talking about, who's an anthropology student at Thammasat University, stand up and read these 10 demands out loud, that was a pretty revolutionary moment. One of the things that made that moment possible was actually a couple days before that, human rights lawyer Anon Nampa publicly broached the topic of the monarchy at a rally in Chiang Mai in August. It was the first time that people had publicly broached the topic of the monarchy. And that's truly, I think, revolutionary. He unleashed a flood of pent-up criticism, and I don't think we've seen the end of that, right? So that's why these protests that we're seeing in Bangkok right now are really important to pay attention to. They're very different than past protests. They are filled by young people. We're talking middle school, high school, and college-aged people, and that's very different than the yellow shirt and red shirt protests, which were mostly middle-aged and older people. I think these protests have now branched out and are also very inclusive of former red shirts who are joining them in the ranks. But it's largely led by people like this young woman you're talking about, people who grew up in the 2000s. It's hard for us older people to imagine that, but they grew up in the 2000s, the yellow shirt, red shirt protests, and a relatively unstable sense of what the monarchy was. It's very different than their parents' generation, and I think it's enabled them to be so vocal and articulate about, you know, questioning or challenging this kind of hierarchy, right? The social hierarchy that's really based in a profound way in the institution of the monarchy in Thailand. Another thing that makes them very different than past protests is their use of social media. They practically grew up with a phone in their hands, and so they're very deft or able at to use various social media platforms that the authorities in Thailand actually have a very hard time controlling, unlike radio broadcasts, and unlike television broadcasts, which are more or less controlled by the authorities, by the army or by the state broadcasting authorities. That's not true of Twitter, of TikTok, of Facebook, and so forth, right? The Thai state has to work with those with the owners of those platforms to limit the kinds of speech that's said.
So as much as you could be amused by this excessive version of the king and I, there is a dark side, is there not? A lot of political protesters and dissidents have disappeared in Thailand, and some of them have been kidnapped and disappeared abroad. Who's doing that? Is it the military at the behest of the royal family?
It's not that they'd ever admit that. It's impossible at this point to know who's doing that, but you're right. There have been several disappeared or dead activists. In fact, the most recent one is Wantalom Satsagit, who was forcibly abducted from where he was living in exile in Cambodia and Phnom Penh in June of 2020, right? And so leading up to that, there weren't any protests because there had been restrictions based on the COVID pandemic. So you couldn't have a lot of social gatherings. But once it was announced that Wantalom had been disappeared, and he's not been heard of since, protesters fled into the streets, and we haven't really seen an end to the protests since that moment. So that was an important moment. At least eight other pro-democracy activists have been disappeared since the 2014 coup. Most of them fled into exile into neighboring countries like Cambodia and Laos. Two of those exiled activists were found in December 2018. They had been disemboweled and stuffed with concrete and kind of thrown into the Mekong River. When asked about who was behind this, what we know is that the Thai army says it had no knowledge of what happened. Officials deny any involvement. So it's possible it could be some sort of death squad. It could be vigilantes. But right now, we don't have the answer to that question.
So since you're an historian of Thailand and have written about its history in both Subject Siam and Bones Around My Neck, take us back to why it is that the royal family have such respect in spite of the activities of the current king. Because of the anti-colonial history of the country, they resisted colonization, although they did, of course, I don't know what exactly happened with the Japanese invasion in 1941, but certainly the Thai military did not fight the Japanese, and it's always struck me as a bit strange why the Thai military has a grip over the country that they failed to defend.
Yeah, the Thai military has not been used in a foreign war in a very, very, very long time, and the primary period in which that military was built up was actually during right after World War II, in the Cold War period, when the U.S. supported the growth of the Thai army to the size it is now, and that army has only been used to police domestic boundaries. It has not been used in foreign wars. So you asked me a little bit about the history. I'll say that the current Jakri dynasty has ruled since the 1780s, and King Wijiralongkorn is the 10th king in that dynasty. One crucial historical fact to keep in mind when discussing the monarchy in Thailand is that Thailand is the only country in Southeast Asia to have remained independent during the colonial era, unlike all of its neighbors. And this is important because in Thailand's official nationalist history, its monarchs are credited for saving the country from colonization by Western imperial powers. And for that reason, the monarchy plays an outsized role, not just in the historical narrative taught in schools for the past century, but I'd say even in notions of Thai national identity. So Thai citizens are taught that they owe their very survival as a free nation to their kings. And that makes it a lot more difficult to challenge anything that the king does, right? Because it locates any person who questions royal power outside the acceptable boundaries of Thai identity. And that's the narrative that's dominated Thailand's history, the kind of history that's taught in schools for the modern period. And that's why it's truly extraordinary that the monarchy is being challenged today, right? So that little bit of history, I think, is important when we're thinking about what we're seeing on the ground.
Well, just in closing, what's going on now with the king? He's been visiting Thailand, which is unusual since he lives in Bavaria. Has he gone back to his castle in Bavaria, or is he going to stick around a bit longer?
That's a good question. I think it probably behooves him to try to stay in Thailand and to try to develop this connection he's attempting to build between himself and his kind of loyal royalist supporters. And we're seeing a lot of that. In fact, there's a kind of a vigilanteism happening in the protests right now, if you're watching them closely, in which it's really the royalists who are violently attacking the peaceful protesters on the ground, right? So you have both the police out there using water cannons, using tear gas, using rubber bullets. But yesterday, one of these royalist followers brought a gun to the protests and shot six people. I don't think any of them died, but it's suggestive that, you know, the king's presence in Thailand is raising the temperature at these protests, because he's really kind of empowering those royalist supporters who are now staging counter protests.
And do they have the same political divide in Thailand that we have here in the United States between the rural and the urban, which is so clear in this last election? Rural voters voted for Trump and urban voters voted for Biden.
Yeah, it's tempting to see those parallels. I think about that a lot. Thailand is a much smaller country than the U.S., with maybe around a population of 70 million. And I think that that makes a difference in a place like Thailand, where the military and Thai Broadcasting Association's kind of propaganda promotion of the monarch is more unified than what we see in our media here. But there is certainly a big divide, and many people think of that as rural versus urban in Thailand. But we have to remember that so many rural people in Thailand have moved to cities, to provincial cities, but also to Bangkok, which is a city of maybe 14 million people, to provide labor, right? And so it's not quite as simple a geographic divide as that. I'd also say that these protests have broken out in dozens of the provinces. So even though the main protests are happening in Bangkok, you also are seeing them across the country, which suggests broader support than a kind of simple rural-urban divide. But it's a question worth further examination.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Tamara Luce.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Tamara Luce, who's a chair and professor of history and Asian studies at the Center for International Studies at Cornell University. She's the author of two books about Thai politics and history, Subject Siam, Family Law and Colonial Modernity in Thailand, and most recently, Bones Around My Neck, The Life and Exile of a Prince Provocateur. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. To help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate free, we have added a donate button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loves, standing along the side of the pickup truck. Headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30. Who will ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone in America. One more.